It'll be first and 25.
This is First and 25, the Football Zebras podcast. 25-minute look into the world of officiating as we see it. I'm Ben Ostro, founder and editor of Football Zebras. Mark Schultz is the senior editor. Cam Philippe is our editor. We have our writer analysts, Chris Soibert and Pat Weber. So, took a month off and lots of things happened. So, could there be too much football? I think we're starting to find out a little bit of that. But why don't we just kind of start with the new playoff system and how it affects officiating. In order to get the additional four games in there, we now have an advancement routine here where the best three of the early round officials will advance to the semifinals and the national championship. First impressions of it so far?
Well, I think that the system is working in as far as the number of the way the crews have been assigned. And I think there have been quality officiating crews working. However, I think the College Football Playoff Committee did not think that there was going to be all the teams that were on bye this past weekend lost. And the teams that had to do the so-called play-in game, either at a home or away stadium, won. Things didn't work out the way the committee planned. So maybe some good crews are going to be aced out just because of the conferences and teams that are left.
Oh, yeah. You know, one big difference for the FBS officials is, you know, in the past, you got your one bowl game, whether that was a major bowl or a minor bowl, or a college football semifinal or championship. But now, for the guys that are in the playoff, they have a big evaluation at the end of the first game and hoping to get a second game, which is a big divergence from what there used to be.
And I was going to say, I think signers are probably playing it by ear a little bit since this is their first go around with this. And I think, Pat, you alluded to this, that can't, or I guess in Division III, you're not supposed to work the same team at least twice in a season, much less 2 weeks in a row. And they may be running into that this year where, you know, the crew that worked the Notre Dame Georgia game, I believe, may work them again. And I think the assigners, again, are just trying to figure out how to get the best crews to work the best games without, like you said, Ben, kind of X-ing out somebody or having someone lose their potential assignment just because they happen to work for a particular conference.
Yeah, I think for the FBS side of it, this is new for everybody at that level. And I think this year will be ironing out some things as far as like what you said, Mark, with maybe try to anticipating results and kind of being locked in to certain crews working certain games. Like on the D3 side, you can't see anybody for the second time in the playoffs. You can't see anybody that you're affiliated with in the regular season. So if certain teams have certain results, you're locked out. Like for me personally, I was fortunate enough to work a D3 game this year, and on one semifinal was the team we had in our game, and the other semifinal was the team from our conference. So we were locked out no matter how good or bad we were in our game.
Which is too bad because pretty much I think the Big Ten is done for this CFP. They have teams in the semifinals, and I suppose the Southeastern Conference, that they're done for the playoffs this season. I must say, though, that there are many good and quality Big 12 and Atlantic Coast Conference crews, and we've seen some of them at work. If we're going to go out on a limb and predict maybe a national championship crew, the Alvarez Big 12 crew that worked, I believe it was the Notre Dame and Indiana game, they were spectacular. I was very impressed with them. So they might end up being the national championship crew. But, you know, if you're a Big Ten or an SEC crew, you're kind of saying, well, darn, I'm out. Although the SEC felt that way many times for the college football playoff in prior years when it was just four teams, because usually an SEC team was in the championship that year.
I was going to say that I would wonder when the last time an SEC crew worked a national title game, and that has nothing to do with the quality of their officiating.
And I guess, too, You know, if you were in the same Midwest region, if you were D3 as Mount Union was for so many years, and now North Central is, if you're a Midwestern D3 football official, once you get to the Final Four of the championship, you're pretty much done. Moving on to the NFL playoffs, a couple of surprises in the first round. And Cam, we have our little unofficial gentleman's contest on footballzebras.com where we pick the playoff crews. And you picked one or two surprises, and one of them came through for you.
Listen, I did not expect that to happen. It was more of a, you know, let's spice things up a little bit. Going to try to see some newer officials at the top. What Mark is alluding to is I had predicted that Bill Vinovich would only be getting a wild card game this year, and that turned out to be true. And I made a comment earlier today that even though I predicted it, I'm still very shocked and very surprised. I still believe he's the league's top referee. So yeah, so we have some new first-year eligible officials that have been assigned to a wild card game for this upcoming weekend. Dale Keller, Sean Petty, and Frank Steratore on their second season, or I should say in their first year eligible. They are going to be on the field this weekend, so congratulations to them. But you can never predict with trends throughout the regular season who's going to work where. It's a guessing game, and that's what makes the predictions so much fun. But looking at the crews for this weekend, you know, some solid officials there.
So the only requirement with Bill was that he couldn't do the Super Bowl this year, right? He was on hiatus from that since he worked it last year, right?
That's the only restriction that was placed upon him in terms of having done the Super Bowl last year. Yes. Again, over time, we have, you know, sort of derived the way that the league assigns the mixed crews for the postseason because it's all under lock and key with the CBA between the league and the NFL Referees Association. So it is not something that we know down pat. But, you know, in terms of being a Super Bowl official, you have to have at least 5 years of experience and either one conference championship game under your belt or three qualifying seasons, playoff qualifying seasons in the last 5 years. And that is a requirement for non-referees. Now, for the referee position to work the Super Bowl, you have to have at least 5 years of experience, 3 years as a referee, one postseason game at least as a referee in any previous season in any round. And yes, as you alluded to, Chris, you cannot work the Super Bowl in back-to-back years. Based on the new CBAs of the modern era, it is very unlikely to happen again.
You know, I think while it's interesting to see Vinovich working wild card, you know, guys like that, while it's nice to have go-to guys like him or Cheffers working deep in the postseason, it is important for the league to find out who those next two or three guys and let them grow into that position before they're stuck having to find somebody.
And Cam, is that your hypothesis as to Vinovich's assignment? Because in Jerry Markbright's book, he wrote, you know, he was for like 5 or 6 years, Markbright was either a Super Bowl or a conference championship official. Then he started doing divisional rounds. And he looked good to me. He looked fine to me. But he said that he was starting to miss things that the NFL noted. You know, he was starting to lose. You know, he looked good. He passed the eyeball test, but he wasn't passing the proficiency of calls test. And then he retired. Do you think it's that, or do you think we need to let the Hockey Lee and Sean Smith generation get a crack?
I really don't think that Vinovich has lost a step. I haven't personally seen anything that would indicate that. I still think he's the league's top white hat. And I mentioned that in my little write-up for our prediction. I do think it is the latter in which, you know, the newest generation. And when I say newest generation, I say the white hats that were promoted in 2017 to present. So that's the Sean Hockley's, Clay Martins, Alex Kemps. That's, in my mind, may not be for everybody, but in my mind, that is the new generation is what I call it. Even though they have been referees now since 2017, which is a very long time. I agree. I think that that's the reason. I don't think it's a commentary on Vinovich, but more so as a commentary on the number of strong up and coming referees that the league has.
And I think we need to remember too, that if somebody doesn't get an on-field assignment and they only get an alternate assignment, we say only, we shouldn't read into the fact that they had a bad season. It could be just a simple numbers game and say, well, Official X was just missed out last year, but he's good enough to work a wild card. Official Y worked the wild card last year, so we're going to make Official Y the alternate this year.
And the way I understand it, and it's changing. Everybody's got their own way of doing it. Now we have a regime change at the league office this year, so everybody's going to be putting a little bit of their own stamp on it. But I mean, I guess generally the way to look at it is everybody gets to a general layout based on their grades. But then it's a lot of intangibles. Hey, you know, this one is good. Speed of game. That's probably one of the bigger metrics, is to put somebody that's more of a game manager up a little bit higher. So you might bump them up a little bit. And then, as you say, when you get down to where you have the cutoff line between being on the field and being an alternate, we might be talking about a thousandth of a point, when it's all averaged out. In the Super Bowl qualifying, it used to be that you had to work three games in the past 5 years. Now they say you have to have been qualified to have worked in three of the past 5 years. One of the things that did pop up during the bowl games, the first quarterfinal round, very, very heated debate on targeting. And the Peach Bowl, there were two calls that really came about, but the one that really jumped out was towards the end of regulation. And we'll have a link to the play on the episode page here. But pretty much there seems to be a big disconnect between, well, it's basically the people who are paid to be on TV, whether or not they're rules analysts or not, saying one thing, and a lot of officials, people who are continuing to be on the field, saying something different. We looked at it. We said, you know, bad technique, yes, but where is the indicator to give us that targeting call? What is the thing that is ejectable in this case? So let me just kind of throw that out there, because we were debating it, before we even posted anything. I'll throw it to you, Chris, first, because you're the one that actually put.
Yeah, I live blogged that, didn't I?
Well, somebody had to do it, but it was a group. Was
somebody a had to do it now. So we were, again, when we do this live blogging, we're all kind of watching real time and we're typing into each other what we see. And as soon as I saw the play, I said, ooh, that looks like targeting, because there was contact to the head of a defenseless receiver or head and neck area. So then, of course, the receiver was injured on the play. So that gave everyone more time to analyze all the replays in as slow motion as they could go. And Pat was on that text as well. And I'll let Pat jump in, obviously, and give his two cents. But when you watch it over and over, there are three elements that need to exist for this to be targeting. One is it a defenseless player? And the receiver was absolutely a defenseless player. He is catching the ball. His back is turned to the defender who is coming in. Was there contact to the head or neck area? And like you said, Ben, bad technique in that he was tackling high. Good technique in that he looked like he was trying to wrap up from the replay, and it looked like his eyes were kind of on the receiver. But that, because he was high tackling, there was contact to the head or neck area. And as Steve Shaw has gone over in his videos numerous times, there needs to be a third element for targeting to exist. And it has to be that indicator. And the indicator can be a variety of things, but you know, some sort of thrust, some sort of launch, something along those lines. And I think that's why when replay buzzed down and wanted to look at it, and again, it was right to be looked at. It should have been looked at because there was a potential for targeting. I think that indicator just was not clear enough to that replay official where he wanted to call targeting on that play. And it all came down to him. And that's what happened. And again, when everyone sees contact to the head and neck area, they want targeting to be called, because back in the day, we seemed to err on the side of throwing everyone out because they had the contact. Now I think with these indicators, Steve Shaw is saying, hey, we know you fans didn't like this, and we agree with you that we shouldn't be throwing everyone out of the game when they may accidentally hit someone in, with helmet-to-helmet contact. There needs to be some sort of attack on that head or neck area. Pat can jump in here, I think, right now and go over what they look at for when they're doing this.
Yeah, Chris, I think you laid it out pretty well. The biggest thing, I think, when it comes to fans watching or even a lot of people that are involved on the broadcasting or journalistic side of it, is there's become this disconnect that any helmet contact is a foul, or anytime it's a defensive player and it hits the head and there's helmet contact, it's a foul and ejection. Like you said, there needs to be defensive player, there needs to be forcible contact to the head or neck, and there needs to be an indicator. And over the years, they have scaled it back because they don't want cheap ejections, but they still want to have, you know, player safety. But even the rules, I think they changed it 2 years ago, maybe three, that when it goes to replay on targeting only, this is a targeting specific rule, all elements must be confirmed. There is no stands, you know, there is no going to call in the field. Replay either confirms every element or it gets overturned. So now you're putting replay in this situation where, and you know, in Shaw's videos, they kind of want the targeting to jump out at you. You really need to see that indicator, either that, you know, crouch and thrust, the launch, leading and attacking with the forearm, shoulder, helmet. I know the people who have said this is targeting see the helmet contact as lowering the head to attack. I really don't agree with that. I think that, like you said, Chris, he keeps his eyes up. He tries to wrap. Yes, there is some helmet contact, but I do not think that he has lowered and targeted and done that to attack. And, you know, without that indicator, there's just not enough for a foul and not enough to eject somebody from the game.
I think where we're going, and let me just kind of toss this out like briefly. I think in the off season we might be seeing a conversation come out where there is a two-tiered targeting, where there is, hey, yes, we did see something that does rise to a level, but not to an ejectable level. So it will be that 15, or maybe it'll be, you know, maybe it'll only be a quarter or two or something that is not as severe as when they do have targeting and then the player is essentially out for four quarters.
In the high school rules, you can call targeting NFHS. You can call targeting. You don't have to eject. You only eject if you think it is flagrant. In my opinion, the targeting we're debating about deserved a 15-yard walk-off. And it would have happened on Friday nights in high school. But yes, it's when you call targeting in college, you thumb him out of the game. And they made that rule more nuanced, so we didn't see as many ejections. But I think some dangerous play is going unpenalized.
Right, and then you get up to the pro level, and so then they at least have the ability to suspend or fine more often. In the end, when they looked at old video of NFL games, 50s, 60s, they weren't using the helmet in these big, you know, these big tackles, because plastic was not going to absorb it. So you would do more harm to yourself back then. The helmets improved in quality, and then it became part of the tackling technique slowly over time. And so now it's trying to essentially put the toothpaste back in the tube. But to that end, let's kind of stay a little bit in college, and we'll go to some of the conference championship games. The one most notably was Ohio State Michigan. At the end of the game, there was what was deemed to be traditional stomping on the logo, which was not seen very kindly in multiple stadiums. I think that we're going to see something come out of that. I mean, especially, you know, the video game after game was really kind of embarrassing. And I think that probably we're going to see something in the offseason.
The conference presidents, the NCAA, the schools themselves have to police this. The referees should not officiate the handshake line. You saw that melee at Ohio State. Eight officials weren't going to be able to catch all the penalties for that. You can't do that. But there needs to be significant fines for the program, and if there are repeat offenders, suspend the coach. Michigan had just completed one of the biggest upsets of Ohio State, maybe in 50, 55 years. What did we all talk about? The fight after the game, not the amazing game and the amazing upset. College football doesn't want to be the brawling league. They're going to have to clamp down on this hard, and I think they will.
Yeah, like we talked about on the earlier podcast with staying on the field, putting this on the officials would be a big mistake, in my opinion, because for every one or two fights that you may need to break up, which is probably even on the high end for some crews, it's just opening the door for so many issues in all the other games.
So one of the things that we did see in the NFL was the unicorn in the rule book, I would say. It's the fair catch kick. It's thanks to Quirky Research, our partner website, who did all of the searching through old newspapers, old game books, play-by-play stat sheets, and pretty much has the definitive list. I mean, there might be others out there, particularly in the, you know, the 30s, 40s, you know, where the records aren't that great. If it were to have happened in the 30s and 40s, there's no referee to get on a microphone back then to explain what we're doing. All of a sudden, we're kicking the ball, and they may not know exactly what's going on at that particular point. An obscure rule that on a fair catch, that based on some rugby origins, that you have the ability to have an uncontested kick. And before the kick, the best way to look at it, before the kick, it resembles a kickoff and it has all the kickoff rules. As soon as toe hits the ball, all of the scrimmage kick rules come into play. We had the first successful one, and ironically, since the merger, there's only been two, and they've been both by the Chargers. Well, I mean, let me just throw it out there. When you saw it, what's going through your head?
Very excited. We're seeing a very rare play. I've never seen one in high school. I hope I can be around long enough to see one, but very interesting to see.
I was really impressed by how much on top of it the Chargers coaches were, especially the special teams coach. Especially with the penalty factor, because the kick catch interference brought him into that range.
Right, because that it wasn't even caught. And I think that this is the first one that we have on record where the fair catch is awarded by the penalty. So with the interference, they do get the fair catch. And then because it's a penalty and you know you can extend the half by an untimed down, and it can be a fair catch kick down. And they were also allowed to run a scrimmage play, too, because of the penalty.
And it's the same thing at the high school level as well. It can be either a fair catch or an awarded fair catch. One of our rules guys on my high school association loves rules unicorns. And he was the first person I texted when I saw that it was going on. Because our very last presentation of our high school season was about these quirky rules that we need to be on our game just in case they ever happen. And that was one of them. And he always says, oh, you know, I can't wait for this to happen. He always says, because at the high school level, there's a rule in place where and I know we internally talked about this, I think recently within the past month or so, that the scored upon team, the team who is just scored against, is the one who decides who kicks off following the score. He's written articles for Referee Magazine about that rule in the NFHS rule book. And he was like, oh, I can't wait to be in a game where that happens, where a fair catch kick happens. So when we saw that was happening in the Chargers game, I texted him right away and I said, you better put on the game right now. There's a fair catch kick happening. And it just happened to be the first one in decades. So it was very, very exciting for the fans of rule unicorns, I should say.
And I thank my crew here, which actually took over during a technical crisis over here. So I'd actually like to listen to the podcast, the first half of it. Maybe I'll catch something. I'm Ben Ostro. I'm with Mark Schultz, Cam Philippe, Chris Soiber, and Pat Weber. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time on the First and 25 podcast.